Welcome to Not Work Myth and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination and our timeless connection to the land itself. Season 7, Episode 2, The Invitation to Tir Naaman, the Land of Women. This is the first episode in a brand new series we're introducing at Not Work Myth and Storytelling. This podcast within a podcast is called Turis. That's the modern Irish word for journey. I'll tell you all about how this particular Turis is going to work after our story and some reflections. As is our way at Not Work Myth and Storytelling, we'll first ask the story to speak for itself, and then we'll explore all the ways it resonates and matters. She wakes in her lover's bed. It's the eve of Bealtaine. As always, to lie with him is to lose herself and to find herself in the presence of flowers and the sea. His seafoam pale skin glows in the dawn light as he sleeps on. He is ageless, but not as young as he used to be. She kisses him gently on the temple. The next season begins. Here on Evan Aulach, the Isle of Apples, the orchards as they always are, in full bloom and in full fruit. But this is the eve of Bealtaine, and here there is something about the white and pink and silver and gold of the trees on this particular morning that shines more vividly than ever. The woman feels the rise in her blood and deep in her belly. The trees can clearly feel it too. She walks with heavy, loose limbs, as a woman does when she's well satisfied. This is a place of satisfaction. But on this particular morning, on this particular day, as I said, all is magnified. This is a day built for leaving, though, not for lingering. She's being called from the bliss of the Western Isles. She's being called through the mist to a place they call Eire, Ireland. But first, she must visit the orchard and collect what she needs. Walking amongst the trees, she loses and finds herself in their song. From experience, she knows that opening her ears and softening her gaze will take her exactly where she needs to be. The tree that sings the lowest and the sweetest is not the largest, but its flowers, its fruits are the most potent. It is simply the tree that is most fully alive. Most fully itself, rooted into its own essence so surely and completely, it enchants. It will enchant its recipient and that world across the ocean. With a prayer, she reaches up. With a humble request, she snaps a silver branch from the lowest bough. Its flowers shine with their own quiet presence, at once tremendous in their beauty and unassuming in their allure. She returns to where her lover sleeps. She runs the branch from his navel to his throat. Mananan, my love, it's time. He opens one gray blue eye. Ugh, can't be already. Sure, the ewes haven't even begun to think of their lambs. Their winter has fled, my dear. The lambs are fat and ready for the summer pastures. Come, we're needed. We, he laughs, we are needed. You, my dear, are about to run those silvery flowers across another man's chest. How is it you think I'll jump from my sleep just to be your transport? Oh, my darling, she says, it's only the work of a single night. And a long season after that, he sighs. What are a few seasons of any length to us, lover? Surely you'll find ways to occupy your own time. Now, this is a conversation they've had round after round, a conversation they've had with every turn of the wheel, all the way back to when these islands first emerged from the ocean. As he rises and wraps himself in robes worthy of a son of the sea, a god in his own right, Mananan and she continue to bicker. He pinches her arse as she leans in to bite his neck. Soon they are side by side on the chariot, pulled by the greatest team of seafoam stallions. They don't speak as the horses swallow the flowery plains of the sea, but she leans close and his arm encircles her waist. familiar and enduring another chariot journey between the worlds. She alights onto a wintry shore, in almost every way the opposite of the lovely land in which she woke that morning. Her steps are sure. It's as if she floats across the earth, even as she plants each foot firmly into the soil. She sees the royal fortress on the hilltop, but she is bound for a quieter place. The sun has just set. The chilly Samhain orchard is cast in darkness, but out of the gloom comes a vast shadow. It is Bran, the king. He has come alone, and in the half-light she can see that he has a strange look on his face. Flashes of curiosity and confusion flit across his broad brow. And that's not a brow that's in the habit of betraying any confusion. This is a man who knows control. He is a man well accustomed to conflict and comfort, too. Walking alone in a dark, barren orchard is not a place for him to shine. And he likes to shine, and he should be doing so in his own hall, all full of feasting and boasting fighting men. But no, instead he is alone in a grove being watched by a woman concealed amidst the tree trunks. This is not the moment to reveal herself. Instead, she pulls the silver branch from beneath her spiderweb cloak. Subtly, quietly, the branch fills the still Samhain night with song. Bran does another unaccustomed thing. He sinks to his knees. He wraps his hands around his head, caught somewhere between swoon and surrender. Brow to earth, this great bear of a man curls into a ball like a small boy who thinks he's well hidden if he can't see those who are seeking him. He is still, and she makes her move, tucking the precious branch into his tight fist, and then she slips off into the night. So that story, that part of it, that's all purely conjured from my own imagination. Or you might say that I was tapped into some bigger imagination, vaster than me, vaster than even the stories we have in the manuscripts. It's an invitation to imagine what happened before the story we know as Imran Bran, the Voyage of Bran. So let's slip into charted territory for just a little bit. There's an 1895 translation that serves as our main source, and it begins like this. 'Twas 50 quatrains the woman from unknown lands sang on the floor of the house to Bran, son of Feeble, when the royal house was full of kings who knew not whence the woman had come since the ramparts were closed. This unknown woman, she's nameless. All we know for sure is that she is a woman of the other world, a banshee. Now, not like a harbinger of death, like a banshee you might have heard of from the folklore. No, a banshee in the sense of being an otherworldly woman messenger. So maybe, in time, we'll have the clarity and courage to imagine a name for her. But before I would ever dare, I yearn to know her and the lands that she came from, because I believe she's inviting us to come home with her, just as she invited Bran and his company. Well, where? Where is the banshee inviting us? She tells us. So the woman enters the hall, and the tables full of kings fall silent. She is seen. Without singing a note or striking a chord, somehow she is the music. She is heard. She approaches the man at the head of the table, and she offers a hello and an introduction by way of those 50 perfect quatrains of poetry. Surely enough, it's clear to all the men in the room why she's there. She's got an offer they can't refuse. As she says it, in her land, unknown is wailing or treachery. In the familiar, cultivated land, there is nothing rough or harsh, but sweet music striking on the ear. Without grief, without sorrow, without death, without sickness, without debility. And just in case Bran and his companions miss that not only is her land a wonderful place, it's also their chance to live a better life. She offers this clincher, and here I quote a more contemporary translator, Isolde Carmody. Do not fall to lazy lying. Do not submit to your drunkenness. Undertake an Imrav over the pure sea so that you may reach the land of women. Now, in her poetry, the Banshee speaks of several islands, including Evan Aulach, that Isle of Apples where she awoke with her lover, Mananon. But she ends with her own place, with Tir na mBan, the Island of Women. Now, her performance was stirring and her looks were stunning and her story was intriguing, but it probably was not enough to convince Bran to leave his throne and his power behind. She clinched it when, with the flick of her fingers, she called the silver branch with its subtle white flowers and gorgeous apples back to her own waiting hand. The branch flew from its place beside Bran's plate. Before he had a chance to cry out, to bargain, to even agree that he'd come on such a strange journey, she was gone. And so, the very next day, he set out in three boats with 3 times 9 men, his Imrav, his great overseas journey, his rowing. Knotwork is a listener-supported show. And if these stories and conversations mean something to you, then becoming a paid subscriber to the Mythworkers Hearth over on Substack is the most direct way to keep the podcast going. As my thank you, paid subscribers receive Tourists, a series of special episodes that go deeper into the mythical, imaginal, and physical landscapes at the heart of this work. It's the journey within the journey. As a paid subscriber, you're also invited to join our monthly hearth gatherings, live storytelling, writing, and conversation with fellow myth-minded companions. You can find the link to subscribe to the Mythworkers Hearth in the show notes or visit us at mythworkers.com. Out had begun. And so, as Bran's journey begins, our journey begins as well. The journey we will share over this next season of Knotwork isn't going to linger on boats or oceans. Instead, our shared journey is more about the shape and the character of the land and the way that the landscape shapes us and our stories. This season, we're setting out on a tourist. As I said at the top, that's the modern Irish word for journey. And we're not traveling to Ireland. We're traveling to the other world, specifically to the land of women, Tir na mBan. Now, if ever there was a time to escape to an otherworldly island run by women, this would be it, right? But no, to build ourselves an imaginal boat, to escape together to a shared dream, is just another form of spiritual bypass. And we've spent the last decade hearing about how problematic that is. No, this journey, it isn't about escape. I think it's more about rebellion and an act of sacred refusal. We will not live under the king's rule. We will not be limited by the amusements and possibilities offered in his feasting hall. But by the same token, I don't want to claim that this tourist, this journey, is about claiming perpetual outsider status, even if we do feel as if we stand on the edges of a culture that's obsessed with the old markers of success and wealth and fame, plastic and extractive and exploitative as it is. I think this could be, this wants to be, a journey toward healing and restoring this world that we all share. I think we're all called to be like the Banshee, who was always aware that the worlds depend upon each other. Remember, she woke on a perfect spring morning. She took a boat across the sea to land at Samhain, the beginning of the Celtic winter. She always understood that it was her work to weave the worlds together. We are meant to be part of the weaving of the worlds on either side of the veil. The real, the imaginal, this world and that. When we bring them together, that's where the great possibility is. But first, we need to be really honest about this world of ours, right? And what's going on here and now? We do myth work not to escape, but to be more rooted into what it is that we're dealing with in the present moment. We are living in dark times, particularly when it comes to the rights of women and femmes, the files they want us to forget, the Rape Academy website and its 62 million visitors within just 1 month. And that website, of all things, is called Motherless. All this horror and abuse and repression of women's rights to safety and bodily autonomy and justice, it weighs so heavily. I want to tear apart the next man who gives himself permission to look at my teenage girls in a way that makes me, that vigilant mother of well-mothered daughters, stand a little taller and slip myself between them and this silent threat. And at the same time, I want to take advantage of my 40-something perimenopausal privilege that allows me to block out most of the creeps and focus on the nurturing, creative, professional life I've built for myself. I want to be able to take my daughters and my beloved clients and my most treasured friends and take off to an island of women on our own and figure out how to solve all these problems. But then I remember, I'm married. And he and I are going to celebrate 20 years together this October. Our happiness is imperfect and hard won, and it's riddled with cracks that have never quite become breaks. But that's one more reason why this idea of the banshee coming from the other world to this world to invite a man to come and stay for a while, according to women's rules, is more exciting to me than ever. Because here on Tir na mBan, this island of women, men were clearly invited, as long as they were willing to leave behind what she names in her speech, their habitual lazy lying and drunkenness. Men are free to come as long as they know they are entering a realm of women designed according to women's sense and sensibilities. The banshee in her poetry, she speaks of flowers and colors and birds. Oh, and there are also crimson purple horses, and a promise that everything will be quiet. Now, if we were fluent in the ways and tongues of the ancestors, we'd surely understand that each of her pronouncements was full of double meanings and deeper truths. So we have to just instead imagine what a 50-quatrain invitation in today's language would include. Come to the land of women, where you can expect to do at least 50% of chores, possess unconditional acceptance of menstrual blood, and voice zero opinions on body hair. Come to the land of women, where you will appreciate a soundtrack featuring Kate Bush, Ani DiFranco, and Nina Simone. Be with us here. Just note that you will not be invited to explain anything to any of the longtime residents of the island unless explicitly asked to do so. This desire for a women's world, is it a little bit childish? Is it a regressive sort of feminism that should be left in the basement with all those CD cases? Honestly, no, no. I'm sick of modulating my tone and dialing back the women's stuff, lest I alienate my audience real and imagined, either because I might be too radical or be relegated to being one of those goddess people. I'm not nearly radical enough. Please see my previous notes on my own addiction to this comfortable creative life that I've created. Frankly, I'm not nearly radical enough. And anyone who has any proximity to spiritual and cultural work that involves the divine feminine knows that it's actually a really diverse community. And there are a whole lot of distinctions and disagreements between those who speak of Bridget and Mary Magdalene and Kali and so many other goddess figures from around the world. To be goddess people is to be any number of different folk. So here we are, despite reservations, the time is now. It's time to set sail for the island of women. Oh, and by the way, as I name divine figures from across traditions, it's important to note that diversity may have actually been a key part of the original story. In the original Irish, there's one word that describes the women, breck, and it's translated as freckled or speckled or variegated. So did the women have spots? Or was this other world marked by gradations of color and complexion? Is there something more? It's worth wondering about. Okay, next question. Are we talking matriarchy? Is Tir na mBan like an island full of a bunch of Irish Amazons? Well, first the matriarchy thing. So I am right there denouncing the white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. I am aware of how much I am complicit in it too. And I'm aware of how it benefits me, even as it represses me. But I don't necessarily see matriarchy as being the opposite of patriarchy, nor do I see it as the best possible alternative. I'm drawn to what Rhianne Eisler named in The Chalice and the Blade, a matrifocal society. So the problem with patriarchy isn't simply that men are in control. The problem is that such a society is built on domination and supremacy. Simply putting women on top doesn't necessarily change that fundamental problem. So instead, I love what Eisler advocates for in her partnership model, and that's at the core of the matrifocal, as in feminine-focused vision that I would imagine was part of Tir Namaan. Because we have it right there in the story. The Banshee speaks her 50 quatrains of welcome to Bran and his men. She describes her world and sets the terms and makes it clear that the rules and ways of her world are different from theirs. It's possible for the men of Ireland to come to her place, which is a sovereign state, without conquering it, without making it just like their own. This makes it possible to create a shared society founded in relationship, co-creativity, and hope that these divisions between the sexes and genders are not permanent or inevitable. Because yes, I am still hopeful. Even when all the evidence seems to be to the contrary, I don't see myself as an Amazon. Because yes, there are very important distinctions between the Amazons and the women of Tir Namaan. For one thing, Amazons only lived on an island in a comic book. The real Greek tradition has them in their own mainland city-state. Most importantly, they never spoke of themselves as our Banshee does. We only have the stories told about them by the men who feared them. You could think of the Amazons as separatists, and whether that was a glorious or a terrible thing, we don't really know. Again, we never got to hear their stories. We just know that outside their boundaries, outside of their territory, they were defined by what they resisted, men and male culture. Now, at this point, we're wandering away from Ireland's western shores. And frankly, I hope to do that more often this season, even as we devote these Tuaras episodes to exploring one particular imaginary otherworldly island off the coast of Ireland. But let's keep wandering. Now, we mentioned Rhian Eisler before. Her work is closely related to that of the archaeological work of Maria Gimbutas. You may know her name. Gimbutas mapped ancient matrifocal cultures across old Europe. And those are the partnership-based societies that predated the Amazons, existing before all the domination and warrior mystique that defined patriarchal culture. Now, there's of course no way to date the origins of Tir Namaan stories, but there's something really interesting about the other world she describes and how it was free of death and disability. I mean, maybe she was talking about immortality, but maybe she was just saying that in her world, you didn't have to worry about getting a sword in the back. So to name Gimbutas here is to stray back into that same risky territory I named earlier. Too feminist, too witchy, too goddessy, too anti-intellectual. If you've heard of this foremother of archaeology, you've likely had a sense of how she helped place women at the center of deep time. There's a reverence and a gratitude for her work that so many of us who are drawn to the lost and hidden histories of women feel deep in our own bones. But maybe you've also heard that her work has been contested and disputed and dismissed. The academic establishment has made the message clear. Your felt response to this material is naive. Your soul-deep yes to all those statues with their breasts and bellies and hips, oh, that's not the sort of evidence that passes peer review. Yeah. Okay, but here's what I've come to understand. The methodological disputes are real. And the recognition, the sense of something true and ancient and retrievable in these images, these cultures, and these ways of organizing life around abundance rather than conquest, that recognition is also real. Now, those are two different things: the scholarly information that builds consensus and the intuitive wisdom that builds community. Different, but they could live in relationship. Because when you collapse them, when you use one to silence the other, it's just one more example of the domination that's inherent in patriarchy. Because in a way, this all just proves my point. There might be issues with Gimbutas' research methodology, and at the same time, her work reveals something deep and true. Both things are valid. Bran's material world, the mortal world, our world, it's real. And so are the sacred islands to the west that no one can find on the maps. We don't have to choose between so-called reality and the so-called imaginal, between this world and the other world. They're in relationship, in partnership, and they exist in order to enrich one another. The seen and the unseen, live side by side, even if it takes different eyes to see them both. So the banshee, she wakes in the other world, right? She wakes on an island where apple trees are always in flower and laden with fruit at the same time. She lives in a world of limitless potential and ultimate culmination, all at the same time. But she doesn't stay there. She comes back to this world that we know because the magic of her place is entwined with ours in all of its changing seasons and fallow times, all of its death and shadows. Somehow her bright world needs that and needs us. The other world depends on us for depth and contrast. And we need the other world for its abundant pleasures, an invitation to reconsider priorities and simply do life differently. And surely, this is only the beginning of the story. We're going to continue on with this, our Touros, in a couple of weeks. Each episode in this series will take us into relationship with a different aspect of the landscape, a new story, a new way of seeing and perceiving and moving with the world. These episodes will be available to my paid subscribers, those who subscribe to Mythworkers Hearth over on Substack. And just a note, if you've been a longtime subscriber to Myth is Medicine, it is indeed the same publication. It's just a new name that weaves together the projects and hopefully develops an even stronger relationship between my audio and written worlds. So, yes, there's going to be a new project developing, but do not fear, longtime Knotwork listener. The stories and conversations with guests that you've come to love over the years will still be freely available wherever you listen to podcasts. A new episode is coming out next week. You'll hear Jennifer Murphy, a dear friend of mine who's been on the show many times. She's going to bring us a story from Welsh mythology. So we're about to close, but last but not least, I want to offer you what will now be the ending of all of these Touros episodes, a series of writing prompts. Because, of course, in addition to being a myth worker, I am, in fact, a writing coach. And my goal isn't just to offer you stories, but to invite you to work the myths with me. And the first best way to do that is often in writing. And when I talk about working the myths, I mean that in the way that the most loving gardener works the land, not simply to get the earth to produce crops, but as an act of reciprocal love, tending to the soil like we tend to a lover or a mother. To do myth work is to tend to the stories themselves, not to use them, not to ask them to do something for us, but to find out what might emerge when we're able to merge with them. So, one of the best ways of working with a myth, besides taking it out for a walk and bringing it to a grove of trees, is to write with it. So, in that spirit, I offer you these three prompts. You'll find them in writing in the show notes. They're a little complicated. But as always, when I offer a prompt, it is just an invitation to pick a word or a phrase that launches you on your own journey. The first, this is a story of invitation. To be invited somewhere new shows you a lot about the aperture of your own being. The banshee is standing beside your dinner table and suggests you drop the fork, drop everything, and come. Feel into your first response. And then feel further. How open or closed is your heart, your mind, your imagination? Our second prompt. The banshee invites us to the other world, to a land without death or suffering, laziness or drunkenness. She invites us to a place of song, color, and abundance. That description is pretty open-ended. So, what does the other world look and feel like to you? Remember, it's not about escape. It's about relationship. This world and that world have something to offer each other. Keep that in mind as you imagine the great expanse of this new place. Our third prompt, an island of women. What do you think? Perhaps that's all the prompt you need. Go forth. Or try this. I told you my own story of censored desire. Of silencing my own longing for matrifocal wisdom and women-rooted knowledge. What desires are you too well-behaved to name, explore, and inhabit? Could you perhaps find a way to really be with those desires and make them real if you engage with this idea of the land of women? So, Shanae, that's it. The first episode of Turas here for you to explore, to enjoy, hopefully to share with others. So grateful to be on this journey with you. Looking forward to continuing it next week. Thank you for tuning in to Knot Work Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. Want more knot work in your life? Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, The Mythworker's Hearth, over on Substack. As a paid subscriber, you'll have access to the special new podcast series called Turas, which takes you even deeper into mythology, landscape, and the creative journey. And yes, that's a new name. You may know my newsletter as Myth is Medicine. It's now The Mythworker's Hearth. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. You can find out more about my writing, my book, The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, our online writing communities, including the Author's Knot, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach over at my website, marisagowdy.com. Music on the show is by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy, a Celtic fiddle and multi-instrumental duo based on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Find out about their music and shows at billyandbeth.com. My own work is inspired and sourced through a connection to my Irish ancestors. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Lenape, whose name means original people.